The subject that was suggested for tonight's discussion is how to be a successful parent. My mother should really have given this talk because her kids turned out perfect. But since my children are all perfect, I guess I'm qualified too. So let's try to put on a Torah basis the principles of the methodology of bringing up children, and also in the same on the same theme, what it is that you want a child to achieve. In other words, how do you go about handling a child, and what's your aim for the child? What do you want him or her to get out of the process? For some of you, your children are already probably beyond the stage where you can actually make any difference. Too late for you. But since you've almost certainly got to interfere with your grandchildren, you might as well interfere correctly. So let's study the principles. I would like to do this on two levels, if you like. One is a more theoretical level, and then try to be very practical too, for those who have the more practical interest. So let's understand the statement of the sages, Talmudic sages, that is a principle governing how a parent should deal with the child and how a teacher should deal with a student or a master, his disciple. The Talmud puts the principle very clearly and then gives examples of people who handled it wrongly and people who handled it correctly. And the principle of dealing with a child or anyone who's your responsibility to help develop, the principle the Talmud says is, La'olam tehei smol doicha v'yamin mikarevis. Let always your left hand push away and your right hand draw close. In that order. First, let your left hand push away, and then let your right hand draw close. In very simple terms, we would say, the left hand pushing away is a sense of discipline, and the right hand drawing close is a sense of love. And of course, you see immediately that the problem will be, there'll be two problems. One is how you manifest discipline correctly, and of course, how you manifest love correctly. And the difficult problem will be how you balance those. Because, put very bluntly, discipline means saying no, and love means saying yes. So, how do you manifest those two in correct balance? That's the goal. And I'd like to try to show you that the correct application of very clear discipline and very warm love, even though they're paradoxical, the correct application of both of those without compromise, and the correct balance between the two, will yield a child whom we hope has the result of that process, which is, very interestingly, his own left and right hands. Okay, try to explain what I mean. Let's start with a bit of a background here, which reaches into the deeper zone, perhaps, in terms of right and left hands. And then, I hope it won't be boring to those who are much more practically oriented. And then let's try to bring those principles down into the practical. Please feel free to ask questions if I'm able. I will be happy to answer. If the questions are too hard, my cranes will answer. The right and left hands are as follows. You know that in the deeper wisdom, are we allowed to mention?
Okay.
In the
just watch out for the fire. Don't throw any fire over. Okay.
In the sources of deeper wisdom, it's well known that the world is built on a certain pattern of emanations or energies, if you like, whatever you want to call them. But the first two that manifest in the world are called the right hand and the left hand. Or the technical words that are usually used is chesed, meaning kindness, or unconditional love, if you want, and the left hand, which is called din, or gvura, which means holding back and holding in, or for tonight's purposes, perhaps discipline, limitation, giving a sense of structure. The unlimited giving on the right-hand side, it has many names, but it falls out on the right-hand side, if you like, in the mystical conception, in the higher world, in the head, and in the body. In the head, in thought, there's also a right-hand side. But when you come down into the body, where things manifest in the world, after all, thought is private. You don't see my thoughts. You see the expression of my thoughts. The first part of the body, if you think about it, when the head becomes the body, the first thing that happens in the body is you have arms. Right? Before you get down to other organs and parts of the body, the first thing to manifest in the body is the arms, and those are the tools of action in the world, or expression. That's incidentally why the arms have hair underneath the arm. Hair grows on parts of the body that are organs of outer expression, when an inner power is manifest outside, right? And that you see by the arms is the first place where that happens. That's not our subject tonight, but But that's what the arms are. Now, and the arms bring it right down into full practical expression. That's why they're 10 fingers, right? In other words, you see that it comes down into full, there are 10 mystical energies in the world, and the hands fully manifest that. In fact, the word yad in Hebrew, you know, technically the yad is from the knuckles down, right? This is the yad. This part's called the kaf yad, kafa yad. The yad is from the knuckles. When you wash your hands, for example, you always have to wash them at least from the knuckles. It's better to wash up to the wrist, but the minimum is from the knuckles down, right? That's called the hand. In Hebrew, yad is 14. And if you look carefully, you'll notice there are 14 segments, right, to the fingers. There's 3, 6, 9, 12, 13, 14. Right? That spells yad. And of course, two hands together spells koach, right? Power. Your power, which is 28, which is the 14 and 14. Right? It's all there in the words and in the body. And that is what the arms are. Now, we can speak all night, of course, about what the arms are. But the point to bring out now is this. There's a right arm and a left arm. And it's fascinating that the human being is created in such a way that they're not equal. There's a concept of handedness, right? There's a handedness. There's a dominant hand, and there's a subsidiary hand. The right hand is dominant, classically, and the left hand is subsidiary. There's a fascinating homework exercise for those of you who are left-handed. You can go and work out what that means and what the spiritual power of left-handedness is. I'm not going to go into that now. But even if you are left-handed, there's still a dominant side, and there's a subservient side, what we call tochel. In other words, it's the helping side, and it's very important. If you're right-handed and you do things with your right hand, use your left hand to support the right hand, the thing's done successfully. If you're right-hand and you try to do things with your left hand, getting your right hand, if you are a brain surgeon and you're right-handed and you think for fun you're going to try to do this brain operation with your left hand, right, then it is going to be, the patient of course will not complain, but that's another point, that you know, he's not going to complain afterwards. But you're going to make a big mess if you try to do it with the left hand, getting the right hand to support. So there are remarkable lessons to be learned simply from the human body, and the arms in the right, in hand, in right and left, and the fact that one is dominant and one is subsidiary, there are amazing lessons to be learned. Let's try to extract some of those, and then we'll bring it down into the practical. The right hand is always, by the way, there's another whole layer to this, of course, and that is, contrary to what you might think as a beginner, the right hand is male, and the left hand is female. The hand of power is the left hand. Right? You would think, perhaps you might think, that the powerful side is the male, and the sweet, soft, subsidiary or submissive side is the female. But of course, anybody who's ever had the fortune, the good fortune to be married, for example, will know that the male side is the submissive, weak side. After all, man was made from the dust of the earth, soft and submissive. Woman was made from rib, bone, you know. And anyway, you know, so that's what it is. The male side is the side of passive flow, right? Unlimited flow. The left hand, the female, is always the side of limitation. In fact, the Hebrew word for female is nekeva, right? That Hebrew word means to make specific and limit. Like it says, nakva scharcha alai ve'etena, fix your wages and I'll pay you. Give me a figure. Maleness means, if somebody says to you, quote me a figure and I'll give you that much money. Imagine a person of unlimited wealth walks up to you and says, say a number. Say any number you like, you get that much money. While this is happening, you get nothing. The maleness is this. As soon as you say a number, two things happen. The moment you say a number, one thing that happens is you get that much money. But the second thing is not a penny more. That's female. Maleness is the unexpressible, inexpressible, infinite energy. And femaleness is the limiting to that which can be in the world. Right? The upside of male is its unlimited power. The downside of the male is that it's just wasted energy that comes to no expression. The upside of the female, if you like, is that a thing is born real in the world. The downside of the female is that it's sadly only this and not more. Right? That's why the word for feminine, female in Hebrew, means female, means to limit and make specific. Asher nikvu b'shemois, right? Those who are fixed by name. And also, it means a curse. Right, ladies? Don't be offended. But the word for female also means a curse in the sense of limitation. Not a curse in terms of badness. A curse in terms of bracha always means expansion, and a curse always means, right, nekev shem Hashem, for example, is the sin of cursing what we can't even say, right, what we euphemistically call blessing Hashem. It means to take that which is infinitely expanding and make it finite and locked in and limited, that is, that's the, if you like, the downside of the female. Obviously, all things in the world need male and female. They need the infinite energy coming in and the female form that gives it a reality in the world. And of course, you see immediately, I'm sure your minds are racing ahead of me, that the dominant side, of course, is the infinite energy, and the one that serves it and gives it form, right, is the female. And you have many expressions of that. Isha, Kshera, Aisa, Ritzain, Bala, for example. A woman, a kosher woman, does her husband's will. Husband's will means energy coming in. And woman practices it, brings it into reality. You know, amazing thing, if you had an amazing experience many years ago of having to dissect a human embryo, right? And under the microscope, as you dissect that little unborn child, it's a remarkable thing. You see the organs that form seed. The organs in the body that form seed. The male and female, they begin in the same way. They both begin as parts of the kidney. Right? They both begin as little pieces of kidney that break off, and from the kidneys they migrate downwards in the body. In the male, they become organs that produce seed by the billion. Completely and utterly uncountable, vastly beyond what could ever be used. In the female, the same tissue transmutes itself into an organ that produces seeds one at a time that can all be counted. Every month of a woman's cycle, one seed only appears. And the process of male meeting female is that male infinite energy and potentiality meets one specific option. That's all. Yeah? That's the story. This is also why we always refer to Hashem as male and the world as female. Why do we always regard to God as female? Why do we always regard Hashem, God, as male? Is it because we are primitive, anti-feminist, medieval, benighted, misogynistic, you know? No, it's because maleness means infinite energy. That's what maleness is. And the world is always the finite expression of that energy. That's why in Hebrew, all words for the earth are female. Whether they have a feminine structure or not, Adama, Eretz, Kelim, vessels, earth, even stones. You know, in Hebrew, an Evan, a rock, is the building block of all reality, right? The world began with a rock called Evan Shasir, the rock of formation. The word Evan, which is the ultimate building block of reality, is a feminine word. Interesting, the Medaktikim say that it's made up of two words, Av and Ben, father and son, meshed into one, and it's a female word. In her, the transition from father to son takes place. There's a lot to say about this. But we have to speak, obviously, about all of these qualities, unlimited, unlimited, male and female, all of these are relevant. But the right-hand side is essentially the quality of unlimited giving. The word chesed is translated in the King James Bible as loving-kindness. The right hand, right? This male quality of unlimited energy is translated as loving-kindness. That's a very limited translation. Loving-kindness is only one application. The real translation of chesed is... of chesed means an unlimited giving. In fact, amazingly, the Torah uses the word chesed for male-female immorality. Right? When the Torah talks about forbidden male-female relationship, it says, ki chesed hu. What on earth has an immoral male-female relationship, what has that got to do with loving-kindness? The concept is that chesed means an unlimited giving. And an immoral relationship, obviously, is a giving, but in the wrong place. Right? The whole concept of male-female relationship is that it has to be absolutely fully expressed, only in the correct context. A person who cannot say no, and a person who says yes, where it's correct and where it's not correct, that's called chesed. Chesed means an unlimited giving, which is ultimately a male characteristic, and it's also, in its good side, of course, a divine characteristic. It's an infinite potential. But that's called chesed. And on the left-hand side is the concept of gvura. Gvura means to limit and to hold in. You see that in many ways. For example, in the Musa expression, it says, Ezehu Gibor. Who is a Gibor? Hamishel Baruchai, somebody who can control himself. Notice we don't define a Gibor, a powerful man, or a powerful individual, as somebody who can beat others down or act with power. We define it as somebody who can hold himself in. Right? The ability to hold energy in, some modern thinkers say this is really the nuclear power, right? The incredible power of the nucleus that can be released as atomic energy. The real power of the world is that it's held in. And that's the left-hand side. Another word for this is, the Chazal say another expression of this is, who is a really powerful person? A person who rules his spirit and has self-control is more mighty than somebody who can besiege a city. Mi loched ir is the expression. Loched ir means somebody who can surround and besiege a city. Interesting, Chazal chose for the metaphor of somebody who rules himself and is really powerful, not somebody who can conquer a city, not somebody who can break through a siege, but somebody who can limit and hold in. Image of a siege is somebody who can contain, yeah, not let things out, escape. That is the definition of gvura. The other word we use for that is din, of course. Din is based on the word dai, which, of course, I'm sure your minds have already again raced ahead and figured that dai and yaj that we spoke about before are the same letters. Right? That is, dai means enough. Right? For example, the name Shin and then Dala Danyud, Shakai, right? She'oma lo ilomwe dai. The name that said to his world, enough. Right? The name of Hashem began the world creating, and when it got to its present form, he said, dai, stop. And then the world froze in its present. Right? That's a feminine manifestation. That the world stops at this point and doesn't spread at the speed of light back to its infinite potential. So therefore we call it din. Din means, right, that power to limit. Of course that's why it means justice, because justice is the concept of setting rules and giving a ruling and saying here yes and there no, and that is the left hand side. So we have on the one side chesed, the kindness, unlimited power, and we have on the left hand side, the other side, the power of limitation. So far so good? Now, everything in the world is built on these two, right? You can't miss this. There's nothing in the world that's not built on these two energies. Now the question is, which one's dominant and which one is secondary? See, people who are amateurs in Kabbalistic sort of research, they see these diagrams, you know, you have the right hand and the left hand, and they're pictured on opposite sides of the sheet, the paper, so you think, well, they sort of balance things. But it's not like that at all. The right hand side is everything. The left hand side is not a balanced, equal force. The left hand side, and that's why the body is built with dominance. The right hand is dominant, and the left hand is there to assist. The right hand side, or love, is absolutely everything. The left hand side is there to give the love its limitation that it needs to exist in the world. Yeah, there are many ways to see this. The classic source is, it says, Olam Chesed Yibone. The world is built on kindness. It doesn't say the world is built on a balance of kindness and discipline. The world is built on kindness. The reason Hashem created the world is only for love. The condition that you need, yeah, the quality of limitation and being able to say no, is not because that's important unto itself, but because it gives the love the correct manifestation. Is this clear? Discipline for its own sake is just cruelty. Saying no for its own sake is deprivation and cruelty. When you give discipline for the sake of love, then it becomes a condition in the love. Is this right? A male-female relationship that is expressed is beautiful and correct. But if it's expressed every place, if this male has no ability to say no, and he relates to every woman, right, in the same way, then there's no specialness, there's no real love that's generated, because the real quality of the love is its isolation and its specialness. That's why marriage in Hebrew is called kiddushin, which means that the woman becomes isolated, she becomes completely excluded from all other relationships, right? Kiddushin means carved out in specialness only for this relationship. And therefore, the right-hand side is the essence, the left-hand side is the shaping, and the environment, the discipline, the structure that makes the love, love. And therefore, they're not balanced. The right hand is everything, the left hand is a condition. Right? You see this in many ways. Let me give you an example. When the rain falls, when Hashem causes rain to fall, right? Rain is a tremendous chesed. It makes everything grow. Without water, nothing grows. But there needs to be a limitation. If the rain doesn't stop, then you have a flood. Is this clear? When you have love with no limit, then it's a destruction. Of course, the message is clear for children. Saying yes all the time, complete unconditional love, with no sense of discipline, is absolute destruction for a child. And therefore, you need the rain to fall, but it needs to stop at the right time. The stopping, and you see very clearly, if you're following me, that the stopping of the rain is not a deprivation and a cruelty, it's a condition in the kindness. The fact that the rain stops when it must stop is what makes the rain the kindness that it is. Is this clear? That's what it is. And of course that leads us to the final point, where how do you get the balance right? Well, if the rain continues too long before it stops, it washes away everything and it's a flood. If the rain stops too soon, it leaves the land parched and nothing grows. So you have an incredible, delicate problem of how do you judge exactly the balance between the two. This is one of the hardest skills in parenting. To give unconditional yes all the time is easy. To be a brutal disciplinarian, right, who just lashes out with cruelty, is possibly also easier than getting the balance right. The skill is knowing when to say no. Knowing when to say yes and knowing when to say no. When does the left hand serve the right in that exact elegant and beautiful balance that makes the kindness a pure kindness, right? The kindness is there only because it has its structure and its limitation. That's a very, very difficult skill. But that is what it is. So far for the theory. Are we okay with that? Yes, please.
You said that Ratin is dominant.
Yeah.
Why in the first part did you say the Lanti has small dope? Why in the order? Because okay. It's the other way around.
Good question. Dominant doesn't necessarily mean it comes first. Dominant means it's the point of the exercise. But sometimes before you do the point of the exercise, you have to set up the scenario. Maybe before, for example, let me ask you a question. If I give you a glass of water, yeah, here. There are two elements here. There's the glass and the water. Which is the important part?
The water.
Which has to come first?
The glass.
You have to set up the vessel first, right? Otherwise you can't have the content. If you're not operating within a structure, the love that you pour in is just going to pour out. And therefore, you have this in many expressions in Torah. Sul meira va'asei toiv. Keep away from evil and do good. Why do the sages put it in that order? Doing good is why you're here. You're not here to keep away from evil. You're not on earth to not do evil. Try coming home and asking your wife that she should make you a very special dinner tonight because you were not unfaithful. Big mitzvah, right? Big mitzvah. You never proposition any other ladies. You think you're getting a special dinner? No, you're going to get dog biscuits. I don't know what you're going to get. But that's the preparation. The preparation is the vessel and the structure. Then you can pour in the content. This is a fascinating debate that runs through Torah. When Moshe Rabbeinu commanded the Mishkan to be built, he first talked about the vessels and then the structure. When Bezalel built it, he first built the building and then put the vessels in. And there's a constant debate that runs through Torah. Everyone agrees that the one's the essence and the other one is the vessel. The only question is, do you stipulate the content first because that's the essence, or do you stipulate the vessel first because you can't pour the content until you get a vessel structure? Okay, the default position is first the vessel and the scenario has to be there. First you need the canvas, first you need the structure, the discipline, and then you can pour the love in. Otherwise, automatically the love is a thing. You notice, by the way, in the Kabbalistic sequence, the right hand comes first. First is chesed, and then is din. And that's because there we're talking about not the way it's built, but the way that it is in ideal. In other words, the point of the exercise is the kindness. Now, to have kindness, you need a vessel. But when you start building the practical world, you have to start the other way. This is a fascinating issue. I mean, I'll give you another example, just since you asked the question. The male side always starts with absolute perfection and totality and comes slowly down to detail. The female always starts with practicalities and details and finally builds. Here's an example. Do you know that the alphabet, right? The 22 letters of the alphabet in Hebrew are male and female. Do you know that? The first 11 letters are male. You have aleph, all the way to chaf, that's male letters. Right? And then you have lamed to taf are female. That's how it works, right? Notice that the male letters, the aleph is the most male. And then you get more and more and more close to the female. On the female side, the lamed is the most male of the female until you get the taf, which is the ultimate female. Think about it for a moment. What's an aleph? An aleph is pure maleness. Aleph is all potentiality. It has no sound. It's not in the world yet. It speaks of infinity. Aleph means aleph, same word, which is the highest number in the decimal system. Aleph has all the elements of this world and the next in one. What is an aleph? It's two yuds. Yud is always the 10 Kabbalistic qualities, right? The 10 of them coming down from the higher world, the 10 of them being reflected in this world, joined by the Vav, which is the letter in Hebrew that always joins things. Vav in Hebrew means and, or Vav means a hook in Hebrew. So you have the two yuds and a Vav, which is 26, Hashem's name. Two tens and a Vav is 20. Aleph is everything, but it's silent. It's not yet, it's only silent letter. The Ayin is a guttural letter, right? So it's a letter that is not yet in the world. So it's complete, it's maleness, it's total potentiality. And then it comes down into the world. And as it comes down into the world, it is going more and more and more down to the nitty-gritty practicalities. But then, you know, I would say like this. Imagine you're building a building. What's the first thing that happens in the architect's mind? The conception, the totality. The architect doesn't start with a picture of a window knob or a door handle, right? Unless there's something wrong with him. The architect starts with the overall total picture. And then he starts breaking it up into its components and how many floors and its shape, and eventually gets down to the particular bricks and the door handles. But the builder starts the opposite way. This is called Seif Ma'aseh B'Machshavat Chila. The end in action The final total perfected building is what was first in thought. First there's the ultimate maleness. The architect has the amazing overall picture. And then he starts specifying detail, 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 until he gets down to the chaf. The builder starts exactly the opposite. The builder, which is the female side, male gives inspiration, seed. The woman starts building the baby, the child, right? The builder starts exactly the opposite. The builder starts with the door handles and the bricks, and ends with the total structure. It's an amazing thing, right? So you start with complete maleness, and you come down and down and down and down to specifics, and that's the last thing you specify. Then the builder steps in, and the architect steps out. Now the female's in, and the female starts building from the specifics up to the totality. By the way, it's amazing. There's much more to say here. You know that, where does male meet female? Where does architect meet builder? Where does plan meet building on the building site? What element in the world is the meeting of the architect's theoretical plans and the builder's practical building? What creation, what element in the world is neither but joins the two? No, come on, do some creative thinking. What is not part of the plans, but it's not part of the building? No, that's the site.
Will.
The what?
Will.
The will. That's the beginning. That motivates the project.
The final
the
product?
The what?
The final product?
No, that's here. What's here? What's exactly between the two? It's not part of the thinking and the planning and the plans, but it's not part of the building.
Decision to stop.
Tools. Tools are not part of the planning, but they're not part of the building. The four middle letters of the Hebrew alphabet are kelim. Tools. Right? And the Kabbalists speak a lot about this. Kelim is where the mechanism of translating planning into actuality, which is neither. Right? There's a lot to say about this, but...
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
Is that how women were created last?
Yes, definitely, yes. So women was created last because she's the final practical expression. Absolutely, yeah. As a woman, you could say it this way. The Chazal say that the human being has two potentialities. He can either be the absolute greatest thing in creation because he was formed last, right? That means he's the pinnacle of creation. Or if he fails in his purpose, the world turns around to him and says, you are less than a mosquito, because a mosquito was created before you in the order. So you see, if you fail, then coming last is the dead end. If you succeed, you're the culmination. If I was a woman, I would say, but the woman came last of last, right? She's the real culmination, right? Yeah. Okay, tell that to your husband when he gets difficult. Anyway, so... What? He's not here. Right. Okay, so there's lots more to say. Yeah. Zachar.
Not Jewish.
The word Zachar is very interesting. Good thinking. The word Nekeva, which means feminine and limited... The male counterpart to this is called Zachar. Zachar is an amazing word. First of all, it's gematria as bracha, which means multiplicity. Bracha always means where more comes out, right? That's why the root of the word bracha is all dualities. 2, 20, and 200. Base, resh, and chaf. Where tunis is, Maral talks about this. 2 always means expansion and multiplicity. Bracha is all expressions of doubling. So that's Zachar. Seed, multiplicity, energy, potentialities. This is why the Maral says a man can marry many women. In Torah, a man can marry many women. Because he is a multi-potential being. What woman in her right mind would want more than one husband? One's usually more than enough, right? So that's not... that's it. The word Zachar also in Hebrew means a memory. The same word for Zachar, which is male, means a memory. Why? Zecher. Zikaron. By the way, the word zikaron, which means a memory, has the same numerical equivalent, gematria in Hebrew, as the word zera, a seed. Isn't that amazing?
Seed.
Because what is a man? A man, the male dimension, is only a compressed memory of his parents' generation. What does he contribute to the child? When a child is formed, what does the father contribute? Nothing. Only a speck of a half a genetic code, that's all. Just the most compressed essence that takes the past generations and gives his wife the ability to actually manufacture it. And therefore the word Zachar in Hebrew means a memory, and it means a seed, and it means blessing. All these connotations. Again, there's lots more to say, but that's it. Yeah, can we move on to the practical? Okay, now, in parenting, that means that there are two energies, right? Discipline and love. So let's talk about both of these. First of all, discipline. Now we're going to leave the rarefied mystical world and try and come down to the world of the practical. The first element in raising a child is a very, very structured and disciplined environment. Very, very structured. And this is often very badly applied, right? In some places on earth, much worse than others. South Africa, we're not as weak in this area. There are places today, in the American environment, for example, Canada is an extremely liberal place, right? Where there's extreme... I was in Canada some time ago where a woman in the supermarket slapped her child, 2-year-old child, she gave him a little slap, she was arrested for child abuse. Right? Extremely, you know, when that's the tone, you can't discipline children at all. Right? And we live in a world where discipline is very poorly done. Now, some of you are old enough to remember, and some of you I happen to know personally, do remember this, that we went to a school where we were caned. You won't believe so, Ukrainians, you probably can't handle this. But we...
I'm on the other side.
I know. I have to admit that when I was brought up, if I misbehaved at school, I have to bend down over the headmaster's table and I got hit with a cane. We used to wear 2 sets of underwear to school. And despite that, we used to go and examine the marks afterwards on our lower anatomies after we got beaten. That is how we were disciplined at school. That's why we turned out real men and the rest of the world are... The rest of the world are wimps and nerds. Anyway, the point is that, there was a time when real discipline was manifest. In today's world, you cannot do that, and therefore parents and teachers' hands are tied. I'm not advocating capital punishment, corporal punishment. I'm not advertising
for corporal... parents, at least.
I'm not advertising physical... I'm not espousing that. I'm just saying it's a fact that today in England, where I live, if a teacher so much as touches a child, or is even claimed to have touched a child, they're immediately suspended until... they're not even given the benefit of the doubt. There was a lady teacher in England a couple of years ago that the child accused the teacher of touching him. She was suspended for 2 years until she was cleared. Okay? So, you know, let alone beat the child with a cane. So that is... Our hands are... We are extremely weak in this area. And in many parts of the world, disciplining is done very badly. Not only because the ethos and the tone has changed, but because people are... unsure about this, they undisciplined themselves, they don't have time. There are many, many errors made in this area. But as a parent, you have to know that discipline is incredibly important. Let me talk about this for a while. It's very important to understand. First of all, and it's a very difficult thing to get right. I'm not pretending it's easy, but it's absolutely essential. First of all, let me start at the higher level. Do you know that discipline is incredibly important for children's intellectual development, not only character? Let me try and explain this. Thinking intellectually requires intellectual discipline. The neatest way to say this, the purest way to say this is that truth is always limited. Falsehood is unlimited. How many right answers are there to a mathematical problem? Maybe only one. How many wrong answers? As many as you like. Right? You understand this? Truth is a limitation. The ideal thinker, a powerful thinker, is a thinker creative enough to break out of the bounds of the norm and think beyond the box and be incredibly creative, but always in parts limited to the truth. And therefore, is this clear? No matter how creative and iconoclastic and original your thinking is, it must always be disciplined to things that match reality, that are constrained by the truth. A child who's undisciplined, a person who's intellectually undisciplined, a person who's never trained in limitations, right, is... You see in America, for example, it's my impression, I have the opportunity to teach in many places, it's very, very interesting, is that American audiences are very often much more creative and vociferous and challenging and open and very intellectually undisciplined often. An American audience will not be embarrassed to ask a question that hasn't been thought through at all, right? It's a creative thing. In England, it's exactly the opposite. There they'd be afraid to ask a question unless they know it fits... Very interesting. Different heads entirely. Each, of course, has its advantages. But it's a different pattern. So the first thing is that for a child's intellectual development, he needs the structure, again, not a stultifying and limiting structure. Just to be open and creative and dynamic, but nevertheless a structure. And it's one of the reasons why emotional discipline is important for a child. But of course, the basic reason that emotional discipline is important is that children growing up without a sense of boundaries and borders are uncontrolled, right? It's very hard to educate them, and ultimately they don't develop a sense of inner discipline, which is, of course, which is the target of this form of education. How do you do this? Well, I mean, you have to have rules, for example, right? A home has to be run along certain lines where there are rules. And there are many important aspects to setting the rules. One is, it's ridiculous and a recipe for disaster to set rules that are unrealistic. If you're going to say, if you're going to set a rule that's inappropriate for the child, first of all, you're going to lose. Right? You're going to lose. You can't, you will not be able to maintain such a thing, and you won't get the message across anyway. So you have to be wisely set your limitations. If you're going to say, if you're going to set a bedtime, or you're going to make a rule, you have to choose what, again, for example, a child is 2 years old, is not subject to certain rules. If you say to a 2-year-old, don't touch that, he's going to touch it. Right? Most men, by the way, never outgrow that stage, you know. So, but be that as it may. Therefore, it's inappropriate to do that. If you've got a 2-year-old or a 4-year-old who is who's doing something like touching an electric thing that's dangerous or wants to cross a road that's dangerous, trying to explain to him or set a rule or demand from him the level of discipline or with all due respect and apologies, the American habit of sort of getting down on your knees and looking to his eyes and psychologizing him, you know, like, we don't really want to cross this road, do we? You know, I mean, which is a recipe for driving your kids psychotic, you know. But anyway, I mean, you know, that's not appropriate. If the child's doing something that's inappropriate and it's age inappropriate to have the rule, you deflect him. You distract him. You take, if he's 4 years old, for example, and he's doing something he shouldn't do, and he's very strong-willed and he's, you know, if you say don't do something, he's definitely going to have to do it. Reasoning and rationalizing with the child at that stage is not going to work. What you do is you distract him until he's doing something else. If you really want to get your educational point across, you don't do it while the child is doing it and having a battle of wills with you. You wait until the child's forgotten the issue, and then you say to him, you know, I knew a little boy once who was touching the electric thing, and he, you know, if you get the child on your side when it's not an inflamed issue, he'll do the education exercise for you. If you want a little bit of an emotional feel for this, how do you feel when you criticized when it's an issue? You feel fine if it's not an issue, if you have emotional distance, right? Husband, example, let's take a marital example. Husband comes home from work exhausted, right? He hasn't eaten since Tuesday. And like most men, he runs on his stomach, and he's, you know, he's been working very hard with all this responsibility, and the world's beaten him down, and he's looking forward to his wife, you know, making a fantastic meal and sort of helping him recover. She had a bad day, you know, she forgot. All she managed to do was heat up some lukewarm cabbage from Shabbos 2 weeks ago, forgetting that he's allergic to cabbage, right? Yeah. So, what usually happens is, you know, husband walks in, cabbage ends up all over the ceiling, marriage ends up all over the rocks. Now, of course, that's not the way you handle it, right? The way a Jewish husband handles that is he walks in and he eats all the cabbage. No question about that. Eat all the cabbage. Now the problem is, you have to say something, right? She might do that again. I mean, nobody could take that, right? So now you've got to say something. Well, what are you going to say? Right? If you say anything at that time, she's going to start crying, right? She's going to break down and cry. So what do? You wait till 2 or 3 days later when she makes your favorite dinner. Then you say to her, you know what, darling? This is even better than cabbage. See? Now you solve the problem, right? So that's how you handle things. If you've got a 4-year-old that's doing a thing, discipline's inappropriate at that time. There you simply manifest the rule, right? And if he's too young to understand the rule, then you simply take him away, distract him. You want to establish the rule, you do it at a time when it's not an issue. Second rule, you never break a rule. You never break a rule. Again, you never break a rule. You can admit you're wrong. Or you can say, yeah, for example, bedtime's 8 o'clock. You can say to the child, tonight it's Motzei Shabbos, you're not going to school tomorrow, we're having a special treat. You're going to go out for ice cream and you've got a bit of mind. That's not a problem. That's not breaking a rule. Breaking a rule is when it is clearly a rule and the child breaks you down. And there's no question when it's a battle of wills between parent and child, the child definitely going to win. He's got much more stamina than you. Much more stamina. There's no question. He can keep going as long as it takes. You can't. So you have to have rules that are appropriate, and you never break a rule, ever. You can admit you were wrong. It's important exercise for the child when you say you said something, and a few minutes later you say you realize you were wrong. That's not breaking a rule. That's big of you, and the child sees that. But to break a rule because the child broke you down, okay. The next thing to know about this is that children are creatures of the rules. Children are creatures of the rules. Fortunately for us, when they're too young to argue or rationalize, they accept the notion that they're rules. That doesn't mean they accept the rule. Example. Let's say you say, okay, bedtime's 8:30, right? A child too young is not going to come and have a philosophical rationalization with you about why bed. If the child says to you why, you say, look, I'm sorry, it's a rule in this house.
When the child's small enough, they accept the fact that it's a rule. By the time they're old enough to argue with you on a, you know, neo-Greek philosophical platform, you know, about why bedtime's 8:30, too late then anyway, right? If you haven't done it by then, you know, you're not going to do it. Fortunately, when the children are young enough, you say it's a rule. That doesn't mean they accept the rule. No child ever walks up to you and says, you know, Emma, it's 8:30, I think I'll just go to bed now. If the child does that, you take his temperature, right? It's a deal, you know. He's got a roaring fever, there's something wrong with him, right? You know? He won't do that. They always push against the boundary. But that doesn't matter. The rule's the rule, right? You never break a rule. The next thing is to realize that, and children are very attuned to rules. Here's an example. There was a teacher in Israel, a very skilled and experienced Israeli lady teacher. And she was teaching in a school in Israel for very problematic kids. Kids from disturbed backgrounds, extremely problematic children, violent and difficult children. One day she was teaching and she saw a child, a young child, 10-year-old child, climb up in the window on the second floor and was about to jump off. And she could no way she could get across the classroom in time. It's a very disturbed little boy. He climbed up in the window, very angry and disturbed child, and he was about to jump out of the second floor window. There was no way that she could get across the classroom in time. But this is a very skilled teacher, and without missing a beat, she said to him, she said to the child, where's your note from the headmaster? You can't jump out without a note. The kid climbed down. And as he climbed down, she grabbed him, right? That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Here's a child about to jump out the window. And she said to him, where's your note? You didn't bring your note from your mother? Where's your note? He climbed down, right? See, children are creatures of the rules, right? You can get him. And finally, on this level, a child will not even attempt to break a rule that's unbreakable. This is a gift. I'm giving you a gift now that if you take this and you run with it, you will, I can guarantee you, right? If you apply this rule correctly, there's not a night you're going to go to sleep without saying, Akivatats, thank you very, very much. Every night you're going to give me brachas, because here's the principle. A child not only doesn't break an unbreakable rule, a child will not even attempt to break an unbreakable rule. Here's an example. And this you see all the time. You don't need me to convince you. Rabbi Lerner, you know Rabbi Lerner? Rabbi Lerner used to be in Cape Town. He was a psychologist in Sydney for a long time before that. He was a very skilled psychologist. Rabbi Lerner said that one day he was on Bondi Beach in Sydney, and he went into a store, and he wanted to buy something. As he walked into the store, he saw the following scene. He saw a very frum woman walk in, right, with a little boy. And the woman started to shop. The little kid, was that a 7-year-old, whatever he was, 7, 8 years old, the little kid walked over to the place of sweets, and he took a sweet, and he came up to his mother and he said, I want this. So his mother took a look at the sweet and she said, I'm afraid it's got no hefshah. The kid didn't say a word, he put it back on the rack. Not a word. Then he took a packet of crisps or whatever it was and he said to his mother, I want this. She looked at it and she said, look, this isn't kosher. Not a word. The kid put it back on the rack. Then he chose a third item and he asked his mother if she could have it. And she said, look, it's not kosher, we don't eat that. Not a word, kid put it back. Then a big Hasidic guy walked in and he walked over to the stand of kosher sweets. Right? And he bought a whole bunch of kosher sweets and he walked out. Kid walked up to the same rack, took a sweet off the rack, and he went to his mother and said, Ima, I want this. She looked at him and she said, look, this is kosher, but it's before lunchtime, we don't eat. The kid lay down on the floor, had a tantrum. Okay? Lay on the floor, started kicking and screaming, bit the carpet, you know, started going deep purple, he stopped breathing, you know. So Rabbi Lerner said, he stood back and he looked at his watch. How long would this lady take to break? Okay, 6.5 minutes later, the lady broke down in total hysteria, you know, bought the whole thing, gave it to the kid. You see, what you learn from that is, a child does not attempt to break an unbreakable rule. There's just no point in it. He's not going to get it. No matter what he does, he's not going to get an unkosher sweet. And he doesn't even try. But as soon as the child knows that there's a way that this rule can be broken, all it takes is 6 minutes of hysteria and holding his breath until he's brain damaged, you know. He's going to do that. It's no problem. He can do it. You can't take it, but he can, right? Is this clear? It's the same reason that a smoker will not smoke on Shabbos. He must smoke on Shabbos. He doesn't smoke on Shabbos. The same reason you don't eat on Yom Kippur. You got 25 hours of total screaming, hysterical hunger, starvation, and you don't eat. But when you're on diet, okay, when you're on diet, and your whole future hangs in the balance, okay, and there's a little chocolate wedge thing with a bit of cream and a couple of cherries, and you know you're not going to eat that thing, and the minute later you're looking at a plate that is licking clean, what happened? The reason is it's a breakable rule. If it's a breakable rule, you're going to break the rule. If it's an unbreakable rule, you don't break the rule, right? And that is the way children are. So the first lesson is, you never break a rule. The kid has to know that no matter what he does, he can hold his breath until he's, you know, it's not going to make a difference. Then he's not going to do it. But as soon as the child knows that after 13 minutes or 26 minutes or 24 hours you're going to break, the kid will have a 24-hour tantrum. It's no problem. It's no problem. From age 2 he's got the stamina and it's going to be okay. So that is the thing. Now most parents, of course, have given in so often that they don't have the strength anymore to make unbreakable rules, and therefore you are out of control and your kids are in control. That's the way it is. So that is the way it has to be. So that is the question of rules and discipline, and they have to be, as I said, age appropriate. They have to be enforced in a kind way, but enforced nevertheless. And that is a tremendously important aspect to chinuch education. Are there any questions before we move on to the right hand side, which is love? Yes.
I'm just wondering to know if it's possible to take what you made as breakable and then make it unbreakable, like for yourself or for your children.
If it's appropriate, like for example, he gets old enough that it doesn't have to be that rule anymore, or when grandparents.
For that particular issue, say you didn't think it through, and then now you want to make.
Why not? If it's done maturely, it's not because he broke you down. You're in control. You say to the child, "Even I've decided that from now on it's 8:45, or if you do this and that and the other, then okay." But not because he broke you down. That's unacceptable. It's because you changed your mind. That's fine. By the way, you can't fool a child into that either. You cannot, when it comes to quick-wittedness, and my sister-in-law has a kid who, this kid doesn't eat. You know, some kids don't stop eating, some kids never eat, right? This kid never eats, right? So she was going crazy, you know, the kid's like starving, you know, Jewish mother, kid doesn't eat. So one day she said to him, "You know, Davy, your chicken is so upset that you're not eating it." Like, it's terrible, this chicken is mortified. So Davy went over and he put his ear to the chicken and he said, "No, Emma's chicken says it's fine." You're not going to win. You think about smarting, right? One day Davy was playing outdoors. So Davy is a kid who likes to bath. Okay, he's an unusual kid, right? He likes to bath. So he needed a bath, right? But he wouldn't come in when his mother called. So finally she said to him, "If you don't come in now, you're not bathing tonight." And he didn't come in. The trouble was, he needed a bath. Like, he really needed a bath, right? So she thought about it and she said to him, when he did finally come in, she said, "You know what?" She said to him, "If you're really good for the next 2 hours, then you can have a bath." So he was fine for the next 2 hours. As he got out of the bath, he said, "You see, Emma, I didn't come in and I still have my bath." You're not going to win, right? You're not going to win that battle. So that's the thing about, yeah.
Having an approach like this, say you've got a 14-year-old kid. So they go to bed late. You don't have a rule about what time he goes to bed. You've just said to him, "Look, 9 o'clock's a reasonable time."
Yeah.
But he goes to bed at 10.
Yes.
And every morning he's like half asleep and he's got to get his ride to school.
Yes.
So you say to him, "Look, I told you 9 o'clock."
Yeah.
You know, make him realize that what he's doing is silly. As opposed to being giving him a hard and fast rule, saying, see him at breakfast in the morning, so you see how you are now, you're like half asleep.
Yes.
So I told you 9 o'clock's more reasonable. So, so try going to bed earlier tonight.
Okay, that's a very reasonable
kind of approach.
Okay, well, let's think that through. Let's think that through. That's a very different story than a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
Okay, so he has to be brought into his own maturity and responsibility at some point. Okay, now, you have to make a reasoned decision about what's appropriate there. Principle one, choose your battles carefully. Choose your battles carefully. Don't fight the battles you're going to lose. You just lose an immense amount of energy and you're going to win anyway. Turn a blind eye to those battles. Secondly, what's good for the child? Are you going to keep losing that battle, cause bitterness and resentment, and is he going to be tired anyway? Or can you win that battle? Or is the message important? For example, many times it's very important to make what's called a machor, a statement and an objection, even though it's not going to be heard. Because years later he'll realize that you were right and he'll appreciate that, right? Which is very important, even though you're not winning the battle now. You don't keep coming back to it because it's just a bitterness and a pain. So you need a very balanced decision about whether this is worth it or not. Practical experience suggests that in every home there are battles that should not be fought. Okay? In my own home, we made a decision a long time ago that meticulous, obsessive neatness in the house would not be enforced because it's too frustrating and not a battle we wanted to fight. I know another home where they decided that bedtime would not be enforced at all. Okay, this is a Rosh Yeshiva's house. There are about 13 children, 9 of whom were born by cesarean section. I mean, it's quite an amazing thing. This gynecologist here stands on end when she walks in pregnant again. It's like a mindset. Amazing. This lady is a practicing clinical psychologist, busy practice. She runs her husband's yeshiva and a bunch of other things. I mean, very, very busy home, okay? And spirited kids, etc. They decided that bedtime is in Israel. Bedtime is something they couldn't afford to enforce because they couldn't do it. So they don't enforce it at all. Not 10 o'clock is a reasonable time. Zero enforcement or relationship to bedtime. So what happens is, as you walk around the house at 9, there's a couple of 4-year-olds conk out under the table. That's what happens. At 10, there's a kid who's snoring behind a couch. I mean, this is what happens, right? At 11, there's a 6-year-old draped over the couch. What happens is, at 1 or 2 in the morning when they go to bed, they pull kids along this kind of... There's kids that get schlepped off to bed from behind couches, hanging from the curtains. I mean, because they've decided not to enforce bedtime. That's the way they handle it, right? Is it right, wrong? I don't know. That's a battle they're not fighting. So you have to make very careful choices. What are our resources? What is you, your wife? What's the energy? What are the resources? What's dangerous? What's not? What will have long-term consequences? What won't? What's educationally important? What's not? The more you can enforce and have discipline structure, the better, right? But that is a... But you have to have wisdom. One of the rules that are not being enforced is damaging. If homework's not being enforced and the kid keeps getting into trouble and made to feel like a failure and so forth, that has to be dealt with. If discipline doesn't do it, you have to think of another. So yeah, those are issues that... There's a kindness question. There isn't only a blind application of rules.
How important is a bedtime?
Is what?
A bedtime.
I think this also depends on this. If you see, for example, in his case, he's a 14-year-old, right? So bedtime is important. Bedtime is very important. It's a discipline. It's because the next day you can't concentrate properly in school and you lose more than you gain. The Chofetz Chaim in his yeshiva used to go around putting lights out at 11 o'clock at night. The boys wanted to carry on learning. And he showed them you lose more than you gain. So they say the boys used to carry on learning under the sheets, like with the torches, because they didn't want to go to sleep. But, you know, the Chofetz Chaim said a beautiful thing. We say every night in Ma'ariv, we say, Hashem, keep away the Yetzirah, milfaneinu umi acharenu. Keep away the sotan, the evil energy, our own lower selves, from in front of us and from behind us. What does that mean? Chofetz Chaim said, the one in front of you obstructs you from growing spiritually. You want to go in and learn? He stands in the basement door and he says, don't come in here. But then there's one behind you. He says, learn more. Go on another hour. Go and push it another hour. You can do with an hour's less sleep until you drive yourself psychotic. Right? Because you're overdoing it and there's diminishing returns. So it's very important. But the particular application in your home has to be judged wisely. Another problem with bedtime, or anything with kids, is applying rules differentially. Kids have an amazing sense of everything has to be the same for all of us, not fair. If you buy gifts, if you buy a thing for you've got a 4-year-old and a 5-year-old, right? And you buy them two things. The parent's psychology is, you'll buy a pink one for him and a green one for him, right? That's a disaster. You have to buy the same, because if you buy two pink ones, they'll want each other's anyway, right? So certainly if you buy a different color, then... So kids, the rule we have, and I think it's a very right rule, you say to children, we don't do things equally in this house. Everyone gets what he needs. You don't get the same as him. You get what you need, and she gets what she needs. The kid has to get used to that. It's not. Kids have a very highly developed sense of fairness. It's not fair that he should get first and I never get first, that he gets a bigger helping, that I get a lesser helping. Kid has to know that fairness does not mean you get the same. Fairness means each one gets what he needs. And that message has to come across clearly. Yeah, any other questions on discipline? All right, we can come back to it. Let's talk a little bit about love. The right-hand side is the side of love, right? That's the left-hand push away, sense of discipline. Right-hand side, love. You need both. Rav Simcha Wasserman used to put it very beautifully. He used to say like this. If you have two left hands, you simply push a child away. If you have two right hands, you draw him close, but you don't change him. If one pushes and one pulls, you turn the child around. Right? That's a formative... That interaction of love and discipline is a formative power that actually develops a child. And therefore, of course, you need both of them, and as I said, the balance is difficult. But let's talk about love. Not only do we do discipline badly in our society, we also do love badly. The reason is not because we don't feel enough love for our children, but we are busy. We're busy, we're stressed, we have a lifestyle that is... I don't know, I mean, I grew up, maybe it was a previous generation, I grew up in a normal Jewish home in South Africa where we ate together every night. We actually had a meal. Did people have meals together every night? We actually sat down. Nobody would eat until everybody was there. And there was a dinner time and everybody came home. And we caught up with each other and we actually related. Today, Shabbos is the only time people do that. Right? In many homes, Shabbos is... Baruch Hashem, you got Shabbos. But for a family, I don't know what people do on a Shabbos. People pass like ships in the night. People don't even sit down together and actually talk to each other. They're so busy taking kids to essential extramural activities like ballet, dancing on horseback and underwater polo and who knows what they're doing. That like, there's no time to actually sit down and relate to each other and just be together, right? The old world wasn't like that. There were formal times. In previous ages, there was a tea time that people sat together and a tea. Then there was a dinner time where it's a formal time. Today, people don't do that. So we are busy, we're stressed. In some parts of the world, people are even more stressed when it comes to having to earn enough and to provide for what's needed. And so there just is, unfortunately, a lack of planning and time and headspace to give enough love. Also, very often parents take for granted a manifestation of love, and that's not enough for a child. Parents often think, of course a child knows I love him. I mean, what am I doing all this hard working for? I'm out the house, I'm stressed out, I'm hardly sleeping. Of course it's because I love him. Kids don't get that message. Kids do not get that message. It takes maturity for a child to know that the reason he's not seeing his father is because he's actually working hard for the child. And when he does see his father, there's a tense interaction because the father's stressed out and tense. The only time that he sees is on Friday night. And what does the father do? In the middle of Kiddush, he falls asleep with his soup and nose in the soup. Right? And he spends the rest of the night with his nose in the soup asleep because he worked hard all week. Kids do not get the message that you love them unless you make it explicit. And therefore, there has to be explicit time. When they're small enough to let you kiss them, you've got to hug and kiss them, right? As Scheinberg says, a child does not go to sleep or leave the house without kissing his parents goodnight or goodbye. Until they're old enough. When they get old enough, they start doing this. Okay. Then there's nothing worse than kissing them. But especially not in front of their friends, they'd rather die. But anyway, so teenagers, by the way, teenagers are motivated by only one thing. You know that? Teenagers utter a heartfelt prayer every day. Hashem, please just don't let me be embarrassed today. That's all. Yeah, teenagers, total, just don't let me, whatever it takes, don't let me be embarrassed, right, in front of my friends. That is whatever it takes, right? So, you need to make it explicit. For men to understand this, if you want a bit of an image of this, it is like women, usually in marriage, the woman usually needs the affection to be expressed, right? And men are, again, very bad at that. That's the usual interaction, you know. Why don't you say you love me? Husband starts squirming, you know. You know, husband says, well, but, you know, we've been together for 25 years. What makes you doubt? No. Why don't you say you love me? More squirming, you know. Because men find that hard to express explicitly. And kids also need, very often a child will test you in this area. They'll say you don't love me. Or they'll say you love him more than me. Or a little child will sometimes say you hate me. Right? Part of that is an expression of a call for love. And it has to be made explicit, and therefore a person has to carve out time. You have to, recently a father told me that his little kid said to him, he went to say goodnight to his child, and he told him a story, whatever it was, and he was just about to close the bedroom door and walk out, and the little boy said to him, Abba, are you home tonight? And the father said, yes, but why does it make any difference? You're about to go to sleep. The little boy said, Abba, I'd like to know that you're home. It makes a difference to me, right? See, so, you know, there's a sense of security and being there and giving them that love, and that's very important. It has to be made explicit, and you have to tell them and show them. It has to be demonstrated, and whether it's taking time at bedtime or whenever it is, or spending time together, that's one thing. The second thing is that we are busy and we don't put enough time into planning it. Right? Mothers make this mistake. Mothers often are much better at expressing the love to kids, but often they don't do it well enough because they're too busy. They're too busy. They hit the ground running in the morning. Things are tense, right? And there isn't enough time. I mean, I'm sure present company, I don't need to say this, I'm sure you ladies all get up at 5 in the morning and you have your, first you do your half an hour of very healthy yoga, you know, meditation, then you watch the sunrise with your healthy bowl of muesli and you do all your sort of health, holistic massage and all that stuff, and then you sit on each one's bed with a loving mother's touch, don't you? I'm sure, yeah. Well, you know, that's how you have to do it if you want to be a successful mother, right? And then, of course, when the last one leaves the house, then you collapse, you know, and that's okay. But, you know, it takes planning, and it takes planning, right? Most, I would say that many mistakes that women make, mothers and wives make, is inadequate thought put into planning. For example, when you get married, what's the first gift you insist on as a woman? A freezer. A freezer. And the first thing you do on the first day of your marriage, right? First day Shabbos, is you cook a blue ribbon Shabbos dinner and you freeze it in secret at the bottom of the freezer in a secret compartment. That's what you do. Deep frozen, fantastic Shabbos, totally prepared, that's what you do. And on that disastrous Friday, when the dog bit the kid and he needs stitches and everything's going crazy and the world's collapsing around you and it's 20 minutes to go to Shabbos and nothing's ready, you open the bottom drawer of the freezer, you whip it out, right, and there you are, queen of the world, and everything's fine. Sunday morning you do it again and you freeze your secret weapon right in the bottom of your freezer. That is good planning, right? If you don't plan that way, then you can't win. Good planning also means planning for quality time. Example, mother's walking around the kitchen, 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, she's talking on the phone, cooking 2 things at once. Yeah. Women, amazing, you know, they can do 5 things at once and get them done. A man, you leave a man babysitting, for example, the child's life's in danger. Because, yeah, you leave a man babysitting, he gets one little distraction, boy, that kid, you know, his life's in danger. So a woman can do 5 things at once. So what happens is she's busy doing 5 things at once and it's getting late Friday afternoon. Little 3-year-old's tugging at her skirt. Emma, Emma, Emma. The kid's got something desperately important to tell you about life. And what usually happens is either you pretend you're listening, right? And the kid gets the same feeling you get when your husband's mumbling at you from behind the newspaper pretending to be very interested in what happened to you that day. And you know it's not good enough, right? Or the mother eventually lets loose and yells for silence, which the kid learns how to lose control. That's not the way you do it. The right way to handle that situation as a mother is you put everything down, you stop, get on the child's level, and you say, not now. You say, Emma's busy, okay? But I'll make time for you later. What's wrong with that? That's discipline. And then you make time later. You make special time where the world stops and all that little 3-year-old wants to tell you is all that you listen to, right? That's what you do. If you're too busy, you have to make time. So you make a deal with your neighbor, right? You've got a lady living next door. You know that you need time, quality time for your 4-year-old. You make a deal with her that on Tuesday afternoon she takes your 14 other children to the zoo. And you are left with 2 hours for your 4-year-old. On Wednesday morning, you take her 15 kids and you make a playgroup for them while she's got time with her 3-year-old, right? It takes a little intelligent planning. Then you get quality time. One of the very important things for kids is the quality of time more than the quantity. Just like the Gemara makes it clear, and practical experience, of course, shows that in marriage, it's quality of time that is much more important than quantity of time, right? There are many excellent marriages that have very little time together. Some are probably successful because they have very little time together. Some marriages are successful even with very little time together when the intensity of the time is very good. That's what a love is built, with the intensity and the purity and the beauty of the time together. Much more important than the quantity. If you don't have only 1 hour for a child because of your work and your whatever it is on Sunday afternoon, you do something incredible with that child, he'll grow up for his lifetime with memories of that quality time that you actually spent with him. And it's more, rather than feeling guilt about the quantity of time, it's much more important to think about the quality that it's given maximally and not with half a heart and half an attention. That is part of what the thing has to be. And therefore, we default also on the love, and we often don't make that explicit enough, and therefore those are the two hands of being a parent. One is very firm discipline, and a child who knows that you love him. For example, Rav Wasserman used to say that when you're walking around the kitchen on Friday afternoon and you have to tell the child to be quiet in a stern voice, right? The Rambam says you can give a voice of anger as long as you're not really angry. You can give a child a very angry tone of voice, but first turn away and smile and count to 10, and then you can turn back and give a very stern face, right? You can do that, that's fine. But the child has to know that you're giving that tone of voice and telling him to be quiet, not because you need quiet, but because he needs to learn how to keep quiet. That's a totally different tone of voice. When you tell him you need quiet because you need quiet, or because you've lost control, he learns how to lose control. When you tell him that he needs to be quiet because he needs to learn how to be quiet now, that's a message of discipline. Completely different tone of voice. Of course, if you can't get it perfectly right, then you have to yell at him to be quiet anyway, because it's a much bigger mistake not to give discipline at all. But those are the things that are needed. They need a very delicate balance. And giving a lot of love to your child does not mean breaking rules and breaking down on discipline. And giving discipline that's extremely firm, even though there's pain and the child takes it very badly perhaps at a certain point in time, that has to be done. That should not mitigate the love. You have to say very clearly to the child, I'm doing this because I love you, even if the child will protest against that, and it has to be manifest where it can be. Any questions on the two modes? Yeah.
What is taking than a question, having been in this for nearly 50 years, the male and the female side of it. Unfortunately, there is far more female input into bringing up children than male.
Not unfortunate. You mean the mother has more time with the child?
No, the mother has to spend much more time.
But it's a big brocha.
It is a big
They're much better.
For a child, but the father, of course, because of the importance and all that. The thing is that how does the father, that's for all the young mothers here, how does the father intensify and crimp that love into more positive love?
You mean if he's stressed out and has busy and so forth?
Whatever.
One advice is quality of time. He's got an hour somewhere during the week.
Yes.
If it's Shabbos afternoon, he sleeps an hour less. If it's Sundays, that he's off. Quality of time. And if it's an isolation, it's taking one child at a time, or whatever it is, he has to do that. That's what will stick in the child's memory.
Yes.
Why not? Give a special treat, take the child out, special honor.
And then the other
By the way, that can backfire too. I had my son, this was going through a little difficult time. Need a little special attention, you know, it's acting out a little bit of misbehavior. So I said to my wife, okay, he needs private time, I'm going to take him out for dinner. Right? Take him out a special restaurant, get pizza, take him out for dinner, right? So next afternoon I hear my little daughter saying to the next one in line, just misbehave a little, you can take him out for dinner.
The amount of input that parents expect of children, that they don't have time.
You mean the amount of
the
time...
The children don't even have time
to
be with the parents to accept the love.
That's true.
No matter what
derech
of education they are in.
Yeah.
And of course, in Torah education, it's a dual educational system. These children don't even have the time.
That's true, but you fit into the structure as elegantly as you can. You're right. In many Torah schools, the kids come home at 5 or 5.30 or 6, and then they give them homework. So, there's no time to play and be children, right? But you have to fit into that, whether it's a vacation, an amazing summer that the kids, whatever it is, you have to fit into it. You can't break down the school system if you can send your kid there. You can't send your kid to a school and then badmouth it at home. Okay. So, those are... Yeah.
Just on I just wanted to know if you could clarify about honoring your father and your mother.
Okay, you know, with your permission, I'm not going to go into this thoroughly because we should have a separate talk about honoring parents. It's a fantastic subject. It's a very big subject. I can't, all I can do is answer your specific question.
Yeah.
Okay? The Torah says you have two mitzvahs, okay? Honor and respect. Kavod and Yirah. Okay? The Torah expresses them fascinatingly in opposite sequence. The Torah says when it comes to... Well, first of all, let me say what they are. Respect of parents, what we call yirah, means not breaking their dignity in any way. You have to stand up when they walk into the room, not allowed to use their first name, not allowed to sit in your father's seat or your mother's place. Okay? You are... Yeah, you have to... All those things where they have to be given respect. For example, it's absolutely forbidden to use a parent's first name. Even if they give permission, you can't do that. That's denigratory. You're not allowed to do that. That's okay. Then there's kavod, which is the exact opposite side. It's not their dignity, it's providing for their needs. And that mitzvah amounts to feeding them, giving them to drink, putting their clothes on when they need it, putting their shoes on, covering them when they're cold, and taking them where they need to be taken. Okay? The second one a woman's exempt from when she's married, if her husband needs it. Completely exempt from honoring her parents. Never exempt from respect. She's never allowed to be disrespectful. But she doesn't have to go and take her mother someplace if her husband needs it. Okay? So her husband comes first. So those are the two mitzvahs. And there's lots to say. But your point is this. When the Torah speaks about those mitzvahs, it reverses mother and father. When it comes to respect and awe, it puts the mother first. And when it comes to doing for them things they need in a kindly way, it puts the father first. So the Gemara says this to tell you that both are equal. You might think that your father deserves more honor and respect as the father, and the mother naturally you feel more love for. The Torah reverses them to say, don't make that mistake. You're equally obliged in awe and reverence and respect for your mother as your father, and you're equally obliged in love and attention to your father as your mother, despite the mixed emotions. The Rambam goes so far as to say that you have to apply all these laws to a parent, even if your parents are evil people. This is a debate, but the Rambam rules that if your father and mother are bad people, bad, violent, they belong to a Sicilian society, you know, they carry violent cases around, you know, they bad, they abandoned you and brutalized you and etc., you still have to stand up when they walk into the room. You don't have to respect their values, and you have to correct them, but they brought you into the world, etc., etc., etc.
So there's a lot more to say about that. And by the way, you have to teach children honor of parents. You have to teach a little four-year-old to stand up when you walk in. Absolutely, with all the laws. He has to know. And the detailed laws. For example, when your mother walks into the room in the morning, you have to say, I have to do it twice a day. You have to stand up in the morning and at night. You don't have to jump up and down and make her dizzy. Right? But if your mother, if you see your mother or father in the morning, you have to stand up. When they come at night, you have to stand up again. But if you stood up for your mother in the morning, and later she walks in, and this time a friend of yours is with you, who doesn't know you stood up already, you've got to stand up again. Because the friend doesn't know you did that. Children have to learn that from age four, right? Little frum kids can get Lashon Hara right when they're 4 years old. You see it all the time. They know they're not allowed to say bad things about people, and they can learn all these things too, right? So you have to discipline. Children have to know that. They're no ways allowed to use your first name. Chutzpah, they're never allowed, except age appropriate. Little kids are naturally have chutzpah, and that's okay. That's okay. But never age inappropriate chutzpah, right? And from the earliest ages, kids have to be taught that. And the best way to teach them is to let them watch you doing it for your parents. There's no better education than that. When your kid sees you stand up for your mother, by the way, there's no age limits here. Your mother could be 95 and you 76. You're still going to stand up, right? It's got nothing to do with being a child. It's got to do with being an offspring. So your kids have to see that you never, you always show the most amazing respect. You know, the Gemara says it's the hardest mitzvah to do. It's the harder, you can never do enough. One of the Tanaim in the Gemara, his mother broke her shoe. He made her walk back to the house on his hand. And when the sages heard about it, they said, that's nothing, you didn't begin the mitzvah. So to honor a parent correctly, very hard. You have to show your children how you do that, right? You have the most awesome respect for parents. Then you get it.
Sorry, what lesson is it if a wife must give to her husband or
the
father? What lesson are you...
The kids need that. Kids, the first thing they need to see is that you treat him like a king and he treats you like a queen. That's right. Husband comes first. Absolutely. The first thing kids need to see is that you treat each other like absolute king and queen. Total. That you come for each other before they do.
For your parents, your mother.
Again, this is the Torah priority. Listen carefully. The Torah priority is, if your husband needs you actively, he comes before your parents. Let's say your mother says, come and spend Sunday afternoon with me. And your husband wants you to be around. You have to apologize to your mother. You can't go. You're exempt totally. If he's out of town, you've got to go to your mother. Or after divorce or chas v'shalom, death of a husband, etc., then it's fully applicable again. But while your husband needs you, right, while he actively wants you to, for example, be with him, he comes first. And everyone needs to see that. And so do the in-laws.
How do you define need?
So you have to discuss the practicality. I'll give you an example.
Here's an example. There was a woman who was in a year of mourning for her parent. Her parent died. And a few months later, she was still in the year of mourning. And therefore, she wasn't going to any weddings or anything like that, right? But what happened was her husband had a wedding in his family. And it was very important to him that his wife went to it. It was extremely important to him, apart from the question of shalom bayis, which comes before everything. He wanted his wife very much to go to that wedding. And she was very upset to dishonor her parent. So she wrote a letter to Rav Moshe Feinstein. And Rav Moshe writes back like this, and it's published in his Shuvos. He said this, mourning is only 30 days. Mourning is not a year. The mitzvah of Avelis is only 30 days. Mourning for a parent is kibbut avaim. And you're exempt from that when you're married. Go to the wedding.
Sure.
That's what he writes in the Chibbut. Okay. Yeah.
So, you were talking about breakable and unbreakable rules. Yeah. So, and now that you...
I know, I was only talking about unbreakable rules.
Unbreakable rules. Yeah. But, I mean, the rule of kibbut avaim,
yes,
that covers virtually anything that a kid, you know, like bedtime's at 8. Kid says no, kibbut avaim.
You don't have to have that. You don't invoke that. Bedtime's 8, because I said so, buddy. You wanna pull a rank on him and tell him kibbut avaim as well? That's fine if you're irrational. But he doesn't need rational. I'm the boss. Why 8:30? Because I said so. That's good enough.
Right.
Yes.
Just going back to unbreakable.
You don't want to bring a guilt trip. No, a guilt trip that now Hashem's upset with you and so forth. You have to be careful with that. Yes.
I don't understand how you create unbreakable rules, because with the examples mentioned before,
yeah,
that's religious. It's got a bit of a religious premise.
Yeah.
So the kid understands it's being reinforced, you know, environmentally.
Yeah.
But how does...
No, no. It's only because he knows it's unbreakable. If 8 o'clock bedtime is unbreakable, or he never sleeps at this friend, or whatever the rule is, if it's completely unbreakable, he doesn't bother with it, you'll see. I mean, yeah, perhaps it's being a little extreme, but you get the feeling. Yeah.
When rules are broken,
what are the relevant punishments for the kid?
This is an interesting question. The Torah does not have an absolute ban on a smack where appropriate and necessary, okay? If you're very careful, of course, you can be cruel and so on and so on. It's much better to have a relationship where a little disapproval or give a feeling disappointment does the job. Much, much better, okay? If you have to get more heavy-handed than that, then you have to get more heavy-handed. It has to be appropriate for what that child actually needs. If you're going to have to escalate to, you know, electric cattle prods and that kind of thing, then you probably missed, you know, you probably missed your opportunity, right? So, okay, let me finish with two important points, if I may, very briefly. Okay, one point is like this. What happens when the discipline fails? What happens when it actually fails? This is usually the problem with teenagers and older who just do not keep the rules. Unfortunately, in our society, we have a problem of a real proportion of kids who just act out. That's it. They drop everything, whether it's frum, whether it's relationship, in more or less extreme fashions. I can't deal with this fully now. I just want to say one rule for that. Okay, this needs a lot of discussion and sensitive and personal objective input. But I'll just tell you a beautiful rule. The rule is this. Let's say you've got a child in the house who's not respecting what's done in their house, right? Whether it's religious or general or whatever. Here's how you handle it. This is a very rough, broad rule, but here's the principle. You enforce every minute detail that can be enforced and ignore all those that can't. Again, if you're not going to gain anything by trying to enforce a rule, the kid's just going to keep breaking. Unfortunately, you have to turn a blind eye to that. I'm talking about more extreme things like evicting the kid from the house because he's too dangerous for the others. Yeah? The kid's living in the house. Let's say he's not observing certain religious requirements. And you know that in the privacy of his room, with the door closed, he doesn't do that. And he's not going to do that. And if you enforce it, the kid's going to leave. They do that today. 15-year-old will just disappear. Okay? So what's the point in enforcing that? But you can say, look, this is our house. By the way, don't give a religious motivation. That never works. To a kid who's rejected it. You say, I don't care what your views are. This is my house. When you get married and get out and do what you want in your house. Here, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. Any kid can understand that rationale. That's not religious. That's because this is our domain. We've set up the rules that suit us in this house. We wear shoes. We come to the table with a shirt on. Doesn't matter if it's religiously right or wrong. That's what we do. So you enforce that rule. And that's a perfectly good rationale. No kid can deny that rationale. If he's not going to do that in his room, and you know he's not going to do it in his room, what are you going to gain by insisting that he does? Then close the door and turn a blind eye. You've been beaten on that thing. But don't give in to any detail that you don't have to. Because then you've still got a semblance of the discipline and the relationship. As soon as you insist on a rule that he's going to break in front of everybody, you've lost everything. Okay, that's a general rule. Let me finish finally with this. What do you want the child to develop? Your methodology is right and left hands. What kind of child do you want to come out of your home? What you want is a child who's got a right and a left hand. Namely, Rav Simcha put it this way. When you bring up a little child, there are only two qualities that are important. If your child grows up with these two qualities of character and mind, you've done the job. And the two qualities are consideration and concern. Consideration means his left hand. Don't interfere with somebody else when you shouldn't. Consideration, self-control. If he's sleeping, you don't make a noise. That's the left hand, control. But that doesn't make a mensch out of you. That just means you're not a damaging person. You also have to have a right hand, concern. If he's not feeling well, take her a cup of tea. These are the two things that make you a decent human being. Self-control, gvura, on your... Every relationship depends on that. In marriage, the principle is total gvura on yourself and total chesed on your partner. That's the formula. Most married people get it exactly the wrong. Yeah? They want him to do total discipline on himself and total kindness to me. Right? That's the recipe for disaster. The recipe for marriage is total self-control with your own needs. I mean, just in giving you the broad rule, and kindness on your spouse. When it comes to a child, you've got to give them both. When it comes to you as a well-rounded, balanced human being, you have to have both of those. And therefore, what you want the child is to develop. Playing with another child, right? Consideration. The child's playing with a toy. Don't take it away. Concern. The kid's crying and doesn't have a toy. Take him. You need both. What does it mean to be a good neighbor? When to turn away and pretend you don't see, right? When there's stuff going on that they don't want you to see. And when to notice and go in with a cake. Consideration, don't interfere, don't damage, and concern, get involved. Consideration, don't get involved at the right time. Concern, get involved at the right time. That makes a mensch out of you, right?
in marriage. Sometimes the spouse needs a little space. Little space, a little blind eye, a little bit of room. Other times they need you to get involved. So what you want your child to develop out of your two skillful left and right hands, you want the child to develop, yeah, his own sense of consideration and discipline and control, age appropriate, and concern, a loving, affectionate child who knows when to go and give as well. That's it. Okay.